The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
So already day three of our coming and going, Sesshin, training period, our open house training period. We welcome all kinds of stragglers. How wonderful to be sitting here this morning. Some of us have been staying here in residence and others coming and going. Such a wonderful image, this coming and going, because isn't this human life appearing and disappearing, all of us here briefly walking on this precious earth, breathing this sweet air, and all of us here in this room and across the whole planet, all of us doing our best, all of us trying to live lives of purpose and to find some way to live with some kind of dignity and grace. This year our theme for this training period are the Lojong teachings, the 7 points and 59 slogans for generating compassion. And in particular, Zen teacher Norman Fisher's book, Training in Compassion. And as I begin here, want to appreciate in particular Mike Shōryū Filaki, who on Saturday evening became Mike Shōryū Filaki Sensei. And in a private ceremony, I performed the Denbo transmission ceremony. In our school, there are two transmission ceremonies. The first one is acknowledging the student as a teacher in the tradition. And the training continues. That's Denkai. I believe 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, Michael received that. And then last night is the marking of the completion of training, and my acknowledgement that the Zen lineage, which comes down through me, the Korean Rinzai lineage, through Sun San and George Bowman, which George transmitted to me, I have transmitted to Mike, and also the Japanese Soto lineage through Jiu Kennett, and John Tarrant, through James Ford, through me, and now to Michael. Michael is my first Dharma heir. Quite a thing for me. When I received transmission from George Bowman, he gave me, told me three things to remember. First is to always continue to practice with great energy, no matter what. The second is to pass on the Dharma, which I have done. And the third, I can't remember, so I have not finished that yet. Still working on that injunction from my teacher. Must have been something quite important. Anyway, quite a wonderful time for me, and the acknowledgement of Michael's devotion to this path over many, many years, his study. First with Melissa as his formal teacher, and then taking over. But all of us are teaching each other. So this transmission is the transmission of all living things to all living things. But in this particular way, acknowledging Michael as a fully transmitted Zen teacher, he can now wander the wide world, causing trouble wherever he goes, and can transmit the Dharma himself, and have Dharma heirs and go on. And in our school there is one other ceremony to become a Roshi. So after being a sensei, when your hair goes gray and your skin gets baggy and wrinkly, at some point you are designated an old fart. And that is what Roshi means, loosely translated. So wonderful to have Michael as a acknowledge him as colleague and Dharma light and teacher for us all. So taking up this point two, the first of the point twos in the Lojong teachings, training in empathy and compassion, entering from this place first of absolute compassion. We've been speaking about this yesterday, and we'll continue looking into this absolute bodhicitta, and moving on from this to the relative, and these two, the great dialectic of absolute and relative, of contingent or essential would be the absolute, and contingent the relative. But this is the teaching of form and emptiness, which appears in the Buddhist tradition clearly first with Nagarjuna, one of the ancestors whose name we chant in our lineage dedication. And Nagarjuna was in many ways the beginning of the Mahayana, this great reformation movement in Buddhism, which traces its roots to several hundred years after the Buddha, after he lived. There was a new, we say, a turning of the wheel, and these new teachings emerged, and this teaching of form and emptiness, and the teaching that both Melissa and Alan spoke so beautifully about last night, this beginning to see this liberation of seeing the coming and going. Our human minds seem to be designed to put the world into boxes, and we have words and names for things, and we the mind sees that either it's A or it's B. But as people looked more closely about it, we came up with the four propositions, which is, so it's either A or it's B, or it's A and B, or it's neither A nor B. It's actually when we look deeply, when we look deeply into the real form of our life, we can see that these boxes of words, these boxes of ideas, are only provisional. And so last night, taking up slogan two, Alan encouraged us to see everything as a dream. And one of the wonderful things as we sit in our meditation practice, we can see for ourselves the truth of this coming and going. At one moment, the mind is gripped with stories of the past, stories of that might be quite sweet and lovely memories, or quite painful memories. Maybe we're caught up in fighting the fight, in remembering what was said to us that was so hurtful and is so hurtful in this moment. And as we stay here, as we bring our awareness back again and again to what is actually happening, we begin to see that the nature of the world is not as it appears. Things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise, as the Buddha said. But we can begin to see that the mind is creating the world. We might even say the mind and the world create each other. And this is where we go with the third slogan. Examine the nature of awareness. So in seeing everything as a dream, we can begin to see things appearing and disappearing. Even we and our children and our parents and our friends and the weather and the traffic and everything appears and disappears. And in this third slogan, the encouragement is, we might say, to look deeply into the real form of the universe, in particular, to examine the nature of awareness. And again, all of these are in service of being intimate or realizing this absolute bodhicitta, this experience of the world, this understanding of the world, where we see this vast interconnection. We see, as in the net of Indra, as Alan mentioned, that each thing is the whole thing. Each step we take is fully our whole life. In this examining the nature of awareness, we might say in some ways this is all we are doing in our zazen. We are examining, we are investigating, we are looking into what it means to be human, which means looking into our assumptions. And the primary assumption of human beings is the assumption of separation. It seems to me to be hardwired into our awareness that there are two classes of objects in the universe. There is me and there is everything else. And we say, I hear the cars on the road. I see the sunlight on the floor. This construction, again speaking yesterday of, as children, we learn to talk, and we learn to put full sentences together, subject, verb and object. I hear the cars. But when we look more deeply into this, it gets a little more squishy. And so looking into this nature of awareness, so there is seeing, there is hearing, there is tasting, there is touching, there is smelling, there is thinking. Certainly these things arise. Right now in this moment, there is hearing. And you might say, I hear the sound of this voice. But when we look more deeply into this awareness that appears as hearing, and begin to ask the question, Who is the one who hears? And of course, immediately the answer is, well, I hear. It's me. And in our practice of inquiry, our practice of zazen, this inquiring into the real nature of the universe, not just the apparent nature, not just stuck on words and stuck on stories, but looking into who is the one who is hearing. As we listen to the sounds of the traffic, certainly hearing, but where does this hearing come from? Who is the one who is hearing? The same question as we are walking. So definitely walking and can feel my feet on the ground. And I say, I am walking. But looking more closely, who is the one who is walking? And we're encouraged to ask these questions. And we often say that in the koan tradition of Zen, there are two root koans. First one is, who am I? Who am I? And this koan can be worked with, and indeed was my first koan, my first, I think, 5 years of practice, were working with this question, this inquiry. And oftentimes in working with these koans or questions, we can get down to the wado, the word head. Just who? So one can practice just with this who. Who is hearing? Who is sitting? Who is inquiring? Looking into this experience, and we look into this not by spinning theories. This kind of inquiry, this kind of investigation, examination, is not based on words. Words are part of it, but it's more an attitude, an orientation. Sometimes we say swimming upstream toward the source world. If you ask the question, who is inquiring. Who is asking this question? There's no way to go step by step. It spins the self around. It undercuts the question itself. But there is some direction in this who, in this inquiry. So who am I? One of the great root koans. And the second is, what is this? What is this? This great koan is quite celebrated in the Korean Zen tradition. In fact, it is the koan that often monks are given to work on their whole lifetime. What is this? Something is arising in this moment for each one of us. We encounter something. And so we can inquire who is the one who is encountering. This is clarifying the subject. Who is thinking? Who is breathing? And then what is this? So this thing, this something that appears in the field of awareness. What is this? Clarifying the subject. And when you clarify one, you clarify the other, because as we move closer to our experience, we can perhaps catch glimpses that there is no separation. Recently, going through some difficult times, I was talking to a wonderful friend who's both an Episcopalian priest and a Dharma teacher. And I was talking about some of the difficult mind states that come up for me, and one is a sense of loneliness. There is sometimes a sense of separation, of being cut off. And for me, one of the most terrifying places. Someone yesterday in our Dharma dialogue used the image of being untethered from the spaceship. The tether is cut and we're tumbling through vast space. Sometimes that is my fear, and it feels like the truth of my life, some basic truth that feels very familiar. And we all have these places that we don't want to go, these familiar places. And Trungpa, as he talks about absolute compassion, is so wonderful in talking about these. He first calls them the, we all have soft spots. And I think of newborns and remembering when I was very little, I was five, and my first sister was born, and my mother was so kind and let me hold my sister and take care of her. And she taught me that you have to be careful of the soft spot. Don't push there. And as we sit, our soft spot becomes more visible sometimes. We find that maybe sometimes we feel like we are one gigantic soft spot. Nothing left but this tenderness, which sometimes is quite poignant and gentle and sometimes wildly painful and nearly unbearable. But Trungpa talks about these soft spots, these wounded places, these places that we are sure are what is wrong with me. That these are the places of bodhicitta. These are the gaps in our armor. And it is only through the gap, through what's not working, that the world can come and meet us. And the teaching of absolute bodhicitta, as Trungpa said, is that the ultimate nature of the universe is basic goodness. The ultimate nature of the universe is basic goodness. And like all of Buddhist teachings, and particular Zen teachings, this is not something to be believed. We don't take that and say it over and over again, trying to convince ourselves. But much more hold it gently and examine this. Is this true? Or we can play with it. What if it is true? What if I don't have to hold myself together? What if this place, this wounded place, and as I said, for me in particular, this conviction of my loneliness. What if the basic nature of the universe is goodness, this ultimate bodhicitta, and we can release, we can let things be. And so back to my friend who was listening to me and witnessing me simply crying, just being in the middle of it. And he said, after he listened for a while, he said, "Are you really lonely? Are you really alone?" And that caught me to actually ask that question, because I sometimes feel that way and I believe so much in it. But it took me into looking more closely. And I think that's the invitation for us all, and the invitation of these Lojong practices, to look more closely and to, in this particular way, looking more closely at the nature of awareness. And in particularly, we might say, who is it that is so sure that you are alone? Who is it who is so sure that you are not good enough? Who is it that is telling the story? And it takes some discipline to look into these matters. This is the first point one, resolve to begin, train in the preliminaries. The preliminaries, we might say, are our practice. Our practice of following the breath, our formal practice of being here, this root practice, whatever it is, just sitting, shikantaza. This is what allows us to look in. And of course, as we're investigating any of these, investigating our life, we wander away. Wandering away is not the problem that we're trying to fix. I do think over time we can achieve more stability, can be more present, but there will always be wandering away. So when we wander away, can we be present, and can we know that the wandering away and the returning, the coming and going, are all happening in this field of boundless love and compassion, this field of brightness. And in fact, the going and coming are the brightness itself. So in our practice and in looking into these wonderful teachings, the point is not at all about the content of the moment. So when we examine the nature of awareness, it actually doesn't matter what is in the field of awareness. So might be a sense of brightness and ease. It might be a sense of contraction and unpleasant sound, unpleasant thought, pleasant, doesn't make any difference. But to look deeply into this, to begin in some ways, we might say to slowly dissolve or melt. We can, we are melted very slowly into this bodhicitta, into this life that is nothing but us, not separate, not inside, not outside, simply the self-selfing itself, life-lifing itself. And as we become intimate, Maybe we become more confused and broken down. Maybe we become more clear and strong. Doesn't matter. All of this is included in this great field of awareness. Thank you. So please sit comfortably. In a moment, we'll begin our say our names, do our Dharma dialogue, and just to let you know, this is being recorded, and if you would like to say something without having it recorded, just let us know, and we'll turn this off. I'm David.
Melissa.
Mike.
Candy.
Jenny.
Ray.
Hey.
Susan.
Adlin.
Alan.
Debbie.
I'm Joanne.
So, questions, observations? Yeah.
Memory came up for me when you were talking about, especially about listening. I did a citizen science project a few years ago where I would go into the park after dark and listen for different species of frogs, different give counts on different weather conditions, and so I would go in and have to go in and be quiet for several minutes, and then you start listening and start, you know, are there a few of this species or many? And where I'd go, it was the American toad, which has this really interesting trill that you might have heard and think it was an insect, but a whole bunch of them makes a chorus, and it's just this really great sound. But I would go and I could got to where I, you know, hear this all the time in the dark. And then there was like this figure ground reversal, and I would be walking down the path and they would hear me. And stop, you know. It wasn't me listening, and it wasn't the toads yelling, it was just the forest. Moving through the forest, and the forest warning the rest of the forest. Nature of awareness.
Right, just doing it. The forest is listening to the forest, and the frogs are listening to Jenny, and Jenny listening. Everybody listening. Reminds me of the wonderful Mother Teresa story where the reporter says, you know, what do you say when you pray to God? And she said, well, I don't say anything, I just listen. And the reporter says, oh, and what does God say to you? And she said, oh, nothing, he just listens too.
For some reason I'm associating to the moment when the Buddha had his great awakening and touched the earth to demonstrate to Mara, and everything stopped. You know, that everything stopping is so powerful. It like fills the universe with this receptivity in a way. I've never really seen the connection to this receiving in that moment. Just nothing.
Yeah.
And then it all, you know, bundles back up. This is back.
Thanks.
You know, one of the things I think about too is the curiosity that brought that present alive for you. The way, you know, you were there listening, really intently listening. And then there's this strange thing that happens, you know. The other day I went for a run and I was resonating with your talk about the loneliness because I was out in the woods and this feeling of like profound loneliness. It sometimes happens in nature out in the woods, the sense of being so alone came upon me. And this Wado of, you know, who is alone? Or what is this? What is the loneliness? And that curiosity, I couldn't find who was alone. And then I wasn't anymore.
I wasn't.
Yes. It's incredible. Just looking. And I thought, I remember hearing someone say once, what do I do with this mind that keeps wandering off? You know, I need to discipline my, and you brought up wandering too, the wandering. Mm-hmm. And well, who is wandering and where are you going? Where is this off that you talk
about? Yeah. I got stuck on the three poisons. It's, in the Buddha talks about the three poisons, greed, anger, and ignorance, delusion. And it's like the concept that I've been poisoned. And, you know, so not seeing clearly because I've been poisoned. And it's like, who could have possibly poisoned me? You know, and so I look at the people who, you know, who I love and care deeply about, you know, my mother, you know, and people who've taught me and cared about me and nurtured me, and could they have poisoned me? And surely not intentionally. And yet, I don't see things as they really are and suffer. And so, you know, and I began to, as a practice, see that that's true. I have been poisoned. So the letting go of there's something about exploring what this poison is. It's true and makes me sad.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you see it everywhere, don't you? Not just in yourself. It's in the world. What you're saying suggests to me one of the basic... well, we talked about it yesterday, actually. We were talking about small children and how they come into the world, you know, in wholeness, but then they have to learn divisiveness in order to survive so that they know, you know, to not touch a hot stove and not run into traffic and all that. We'll never know whether wholeness comes first and then divisiveness or the poison, we could call them the poisons. But I remember debating this early on, probably 15 years ago, with a good friend who was an Episcopal priest who actually defrocked and became a psychoanalyst but still believed in original sin. And you know, in Buddhism, I've been taught about this wholeness as the origination. And so where did the poisoning come from? Greed, anger, and ignorance, or greed, anger, and delusion. And he's, I'll never forget, he said, so, yeah, there's one way of looking at babies as completely wonderful, whole, you know, just, but when they're hungry, they start screaming. They're greedy, right? And then they get angry. And they don't really see things as they are. So these little bundles of greed, anger, and ignorance.
Oh, so cute.
So cute. And I was actually reading an article the other day that newborns are really not attractive, but they get really cute within a few weeks, just as they're beginning to differentiate. And the human beings see cuteness as something to care for. Same thing with puppies when they're 6 weeks old. Puppies are at their cutest and they're really not attractive when they first tumble out of the womb. So there's some way that we have to love in spite of these energies of division that arise for people and that are so important for survival. You know, without them, and this is where we talked yesterday, Alan and I, about, and David alluded to it as well, the interpenetration of the absolute and the relative, that if you favor the absolute, where there's no such thing as the three poisons or division, or that's a recipe for a lot of foolishness, right? It's dangerous, and it can be really harmful, because it's not just about dropping everything and floating in space. It's really about, and in the Mahayana, David talked about Nagarjuna, and then later in the Mahayana, the teachings shifted around the three poisons, so that they were valued as entry points to what the seed in the middle of them. So the greed is really about connecting. I want you. I love you. I want connection. Give me the breast already. You know, I want this connection. And that's beautiful. So greed contains the seed of love. And ignorance contains, delusion contains the seed of a kind of equanimity, of the capacity to move back and forth. And anger contains the seed of wisdom. There's this, this is wrong. You can almost feel the arm, the sword of Manjushri, slicing through. You know, and then suddenly there's clarity that arises there. So instead of saying they're poisons that need antidotes, which is the original teachings, the Mahayana shifted that to the poison in the peacock creates the beautiful colors of the feathers. Peacocks can eat poison, and it transmutes. So this transmuting of everything into the Dharma is just what David was pointing at. Everything is it. See all things as the truth. Mm-hmm. And that's, he said, the mind is a dividing instrument, so it can't do it. But the practice and the body and the heart engaged really knows this already, and it just has to be revealed. So it's a really important point that you bring up. Thank you for naming it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, continuing this same discussion, I sometimes I have the experience of something that I've said in the sutra book 100 times, I'll suddenly hear, you know, for the first time. And so once for the first time in the Gatha, I heard, on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, and I realized that I'd always been reading that, I mean, I hadn't been mispronouncing it, but I'd been reading it as though it was endless. Oh yeah, this greed, anger, and ignorance, they're just endless. But it's not endless. It's beginningless. And I really started to sit with that. And so, you know, and one of the things that came up for me is, it's so different from psychoanalysis where you're trying to trace back to some, this is what happened, but it's not mommy, it's not daddy, it's not wicked cousin Eric. I don't have a cousin Eric. It's not the bored, neglectful babysitter. Because, for one reason, because wicked cousin Eric became wicked for some karmic consequences that came still earlier, and the babysitter was bored and neglectful because somehow she never learned to be, or he never learned to be nurturing. And it's not, you know, my genes, because those, I mean, we can go all the way back to the primal ooze, you know, with the genetic component of greed, anger, and ignorance. And it just, for me, it was just, okay, this is part of the koan of being human. The Buddhism doesn't have a fall myth, you know, not in our individual lives and not cosmic. There's no Adam and Eve in Buddhism, and I like where Melissa ended up better, you know, than where I am right now, and I'm really, you know, and now I gotta incorporate that in my thinking about this, but just no cause, beginningless, and so the, and then the freedom not to have to trace it back, and just live with this calm of being greedy, angry, and ignorant.
And also, I think we need to be careful about these Buddhist teachings, like of
you know, this image of the teachings are the raft, and when you get to the other shore, you don't have to carry the raft on your back. So, such skillful teachings, and I love your inquiry into this, Ray. I feel like you're really, so what is this? But show me where this ignorance is, you know, bring forth this poison, right? Has there ever been any poison from the very beginning? And I sort of catch that in your question a little bit. So the different levels. So on one level, if you say, oh yes, we're all one, it's not a problem. But if you say, yeah, I'm just greedy and that's my problem. Mm-hmm. These Lojong teachings in particular about this possibility of transforming everything, not just most everything, except the greed, anger, and ignorance. But as Melissa said, you know, everything is the Buddha nature. And if the nature of the universe is this unlimited compassion, that includes everything, not one single thing left out.
Well, and also it's important to know that we don't do the transforming. We set up conditions for the transformation to happen through our practice of awareness. But the bodhicitta, the energy, we talked about that yesterday, it's this pure energy that's moving towards awakening. It gets channeled through the meditation practice and does the transforming. We're off the hook. It's right. Not our responsibility to change things and shift things and work on stuff. Instead, there's an allowing. We allow what wants to happen and just, you know, get out of the way.
Yeah.
Right? Because we're in the way so much when we try to trace the source, when we try to find the blame, when we try to figure it all out, that we're getting in the way of this natural bodhicitta, heart, awakened heart that just wants to manifest itself and is manifesting itself as everything without exception. That's the other thing that the mind struggles with. How could the things I don't like be it too?
Yeah. So let's inquire into the matter a little bit more here.